Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Ah, 'tis the season for making lists. So let's make one together. I want to hear all of your year-in-review recommendations. Movies, TV, books. Which pieces do you think told us something about ourselves as a society right now? Things that offered windows into our collective soul. We'll be joined by the New York Times' co-chief film critic, A.O. Scott, who's been thinking about the increasingly blurred line between performance and real modern life. Plus, I'll share some musical history that grabbed me this year. A Black woman who was called the voice of a century and who captured the globe's ears with her empathy.
And that's the thing about her. I mean, no matter what she was singing, she made it seem so personal, like she had lived that experience.
Find out who she was coming up on the United States of Anxiety.
Can you name one piece of art or cultural representation that has sustained you this past year?
Jane the Virgin on Netflix. The elements of magical realism just created such moments of joy, and it just points out that life is absurd in and of itself, and even the things that feel mundane and, like, trivial, there's magic in it.
The film The Good Liar, oh my God, the twists and turns, and then, like, right when you think you've solved it, no. It's a completely different ending.
What sustained me is artists on social media showing through their art that, like, we're not alone. There are also other people going through the same thing.
My friends and I started a theater company over Zoom. Creating art has been a really helpful outlet for me.
I saw the film Licorice Pizza, which I loved. It was just so, like, buoyant and lively. It kind of just restored my faith in the film industry and kind of in people.
The supportive community on TikTok, like, seeing people interact and, like, really look out for people, that's been, like, very uplifting to see.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. And friends, let me share with you that I do enjoy a year-end list. Because honestly, I miss a lot along the way in a year. And now's when I learn what I got to go back and experience. This year, I get the special treat of turning to you for help. I want to hear all of your recommendations for art and culture that grabs you in 2021. I'm talking movies, TV, books, TikToks, whatever it is. Which pieces told us something about ourselves as a society right now and why? That's important. I want to hear the why. But first, I am also turning to someone who does this for a living. I am particularly bad at keeping up with film, or I guess I should say streaming of all sorts at this point. So I'm excited to talk with A.O. Scott, who is the chief film critic for the New York Times. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Kai.
And the Best Performers issue of the Times Magazine is out this week. A.O. Scott introduces the issue with an essay and, of course, his own lists. And we should say you go by Tony, right? Not by your fancy byline initials, A.O.
Yeah, I hide behind the byline, but I'm Tony to my friends. So
okay, well, I'm glad
you're in that category.
Me and all of our listeners are now your friends, Tony.
Excellent.
So thanks for coming on. In your opening essay for the issue, you seem to kind of wrestle with the premise of your job. I have to say, it sort of it forces you into this disorienting debate over what a performance is in the context of modern life. And you've got this great line about the past couple of years. You write, "The shadows on the wall of Plato's cave stopped being metaphors; they were us." What were you getting at?
Well, one thing that has really struck me in the last 2 years is. Well, a few things. One is how much time we spend on screens, you know. And, you know, right at this moment, you and I are looking at each other on screen.
On
so
screen.
In some way, you know, what we're doing is a performance, is a screen performance. And in the first year of this pandemic situation, when we were all, you know, not leaving home as much and even more tied to our screens, it began to occur to me that this boundary that we think about between life and performance, between the screen and real life, has been steadily eroding, maybe over the last 100 or more years. And I was really fascinated this time by the performances that I saw by actors working in a range of styles and different approaches that really were trying to get at, in new ways, what it is to be authentic in a performance, which in a way is a contradiction. The whole thing about a performance is that it's not authentic. Right. It's pretending. Right. Somebody is acting like someone else. In a lot of cases this year, some of the most interesting performances I saw were people pretending, in effect, to be themselves. One of the performers on the list is Bo Burnham, whose yeah. Netflix special Inside was sort of a Netflix stand-up comedy special in a room by himself, playing mm-hmm. himself and playing with the idea of being a self on the internet, on the screen, on Zoom, in all of the new mediated ways we've found. So I did find, as you say, that the sort of the premises of my job, which is to be able to understand and analyze and evaluate and judge what people are doing, what actors are doing when they're performing, felt a little bit kind of shaky, a little bit undermined. I wasn't quite sure anymore.
I just to stick for a minute with, you know, how this affects us before we talk about the sort of the performances or the professional performances, I guess. I think it is increasingly hard for all of us to distinguish, as you point out, between experience and performance. And I guess my first question is, do you think that's just, is that a technology question for ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Or is there something deeper that's at work? You know, I know you're a film critic, but it also makes you think about us as humans. I mean, is there something yeah. deeper at work here in our society than just the technology part of it?
Well, I it's a good question because I mean, technology and culture are always closely linked and influence each other in different kind of back and forth ways. But I do think that our experiences of each other, you know, our experiences of human interaction have changed a lot, not just through the pandemic, but maybe that sort of intensified it and made it more visible, but through the rise of social media, certainly. And, you know, through also, I think that the political and ideological fragmentation and disharmony that's such a part of our life in this country. And I don't, you know, you can't say what's mm-hmm. cause and what's effect ever, right? It's all chickens and eggs. But I do feel like there is something, and in a way this essay was an attempt to articulate it, to try to mm-hmm. begin to make sense of it, some aspects of it for myself. But I do feel like things are that there are shifts underway that are partly technological and partly cultural that we don't quite understand yet, including having to do with just how we consume different kinds of stories and representations. You know, whether we're going to movie theaters or going to in-person performances or watching things streamed into our homes, all of those are the way that we organize and order our time. And our consumption of whatever we're calling culture or art or stories or representations or performances or vicarious experiences, that is changing. And it's having, I think, effects on how we are as individuals and as a society.
I heard, I read in the essay a quiet call to arms maybe around coming to characters and each other with curiosity as opposed to, I don't know what else, but talk about that a little bit.
Well, I was thinking about this because I was trying to think about, you know, what makes different forms, different genres, different media different. You know, why I write about movies, so I have certain biases towards, you know, non-serial, let's say, single standalone stories, what we used to call movies. And it's different, you know, if you're watching a TV series, you have a different kind of relationship to things. And if you're watching TikTok or you know other kinds of videos, or if you're on Instagram or Twitter, it's something else. And one thing I always worry about as a critic is that we're going to get locked into our habits and patterns and established tastes. That we're going to, in a way, become prisoners of the algorithm, you know, that we like one thing and Netflix or whoever or Apple Music or Spotify will say, well, you'll also like this thing. And we'll become sort of passive and incurious. And also, we will only seek out people who we recognize or feel comfortable with or think are deserving of our empathy or who are, to use, you know, two very problematic words in criticism, likable or relatable, you know, who we can identify with or like or relate to. And I think that that can be very limiting. And I was thinking, well, I like looking at people who I don't know, who I don't understand, who I want to learn about, who I may not feel entirely comfortable with, but I'm thinking, well, I want to know what this person is going through. I want to know who this person is. And I think that actors and really good performers can do that, can sort of take an initial recognition or curiosity and just go with it. I mean, I'm thinking of Denzel Washington's extraordinary performance as Macbeth in this movie that Joel Cohen has made of Macbeth. And
that is
that's
coming.
A character. Yeah, it's coming out. It'll be in theaters and on Apple TV at the end of the year. And you know, it's a play that may or may not be familiar, but the character feels completely new. And you think I was watching it and thinking, well, you know, this guy is terrifying, and he's doing some very, very terrible things. But I do want to know what is going on inside his head. I do want to know how he understands himself and his own actions. And that's not necessarily about, that's certainly not about likability or relatability or even in a way empathy. It's about recognition of the human circumstance and the human temperament and the human personality that exists in this character, and that this actor, who I think is, you know, maybe the greatest of all right now, is putting into that character.
Denzel Washington makes it onto your list of best performances for this performance. And it is kind of his thing, right? To make us sort of curious about some awful person that has become something of his genre, at least for me. You mentioned Bo Burnham and Inside. One of the themes that it seems, so I want to talk about some of the themes that you've seen this year. One of the themes it seems that comes up is loneliness. And Inside is certainly an example of that. So tell us more about that film and what struck you about the performance around loneliness.
Well, I thought, you know, it's this kind of idea where Bo Burnham is sitting in a room with a camera and a lighting rig and himself and sort of some sound effects. And it's edited so that you don't know how long it's lasting. I mean, it's 90 minutes long, but it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be one day. It's that sort of experience that a lot of us have had during the pandemic of feeling time and our own experience sort of getting away from us and becoming very, very sort of shapeless and elastic. And it's also about the kind of the terrible situation of living in your own head, of trying to figure out who you are and how you're going to be in the absence of any immediate human interaction. And a lot of that is referencing not just you know, lockdown and the literal physical situation of being in a room by yourself, but also the way we live in social media and on the internet and on screens, with, you know, where we're interacting with people who aren't quite real to us, or who we don't know if they're real or not. So he does a lot with Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, and the ways that these allow us to have these counterfeit relationships with other people and with ourselves. So the feeling of loneliness in this movie is very profound. And it's very funny. There's a lot of satire of internet culture kind of folded into it. And he has these funny songs that he sings about Instagram and Tinder and all of these things. But at the core of it is just this feeling of real isolation, of real solitude. That as smart as you are, as you know, kind of eloquent and sophisticated and knowing and ironic as he is in all of his takes on contemporary culture, that doesn't solve the problem of loneliness. You can be the smartest person in the world, and you can't think yourself out of this in this case, literal box that he's inside of.
I have to imagine a lot of people over the last couple of years can relate to that thought.
It was almost too real. I resisted watching it for a very long time. People were talking about it and writing about it. And I even started it on Netflix a few times. It wasn't reviewed as a movie, so I could catch up with it a little later. But I was just thinking, this is a little too close. It's a little too real. You know, I've lived this for 18, 19, 20 months. I'm not sure I want to just go into this other guy's version of it, but it is worth it. It's and it goes back to what we were saying before about curiosity. You know, it's not a comfortable thing to watch. It's not, I mean, it's very funny and it's very clever, but it's not a lot of fun. And I think there's value in experiences and performances that are troubling or disturbing or too close to home in some way.
I'm talking with A.O. Scott, co-chief film critic at The New York Times, about the Best Performers issue of The Times Magazine, which is out now. And we'll talk more after a break.
Hi, everyone. This is Kusha. I'm a producer. Here's a listener voicemail we got in response to last week's episode about the Supreme Court and the current case on abortion. If you have a response to this episode or anything else, email us. The address is anxiety@wnyc.org. Written messages are great. Voice recordings, even better. Again, the address is anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks. Here's the message.
This is all about communication, and the left is failing at this on so many fronts. In the latest instance, it seems the left is unaware that there are parallel arguments underway. The language of the left is my body, my right, my life. The language of the right is unborn life, murder. Brett Kavanaugh is one example of people on the right who seem to have appropriated the language of the left to shut down an unwanted discussion by saying he was offended, which is considered a concept of the left. I've heard some anti-vaxxers using the my body, my right argument against being vaccinated. Once victories in steering the language of the argument are had, then more nuanced, loftier, concrete ideas can be introduced. This is what I'm trying to say.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
Little collection of sounds from the big and little screen this year, many of which maybe sparked some emotional memories for some of you. We heard a bit, let me tick some of them off here. We heard a bit of West Side Story, The Green Knight, Squid Game, Tick, Tick, Boom, In the Heights, Judas and the Black Messiah, Succession, of course, and Summer of Soul. So maybe some of those are on your own best of list for 2021. If so, call us up, tell us why. I want to hear all of your recommendations for art and culture that grabbed you this year. It can be movies, TV, books, whatever. But which pieces told us something about ourselves and our society right now? And why? 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. You can also tweet us using the hashtag US of Anxiety. I'm joined by A.O. Scott, the co-chief film critic for The New York Times. And Tony, before the break, we were talking about loneliness in Bo Burnham's Inside. There's another film that makes, or a set of performances that make your best of list that I also love. This is Passing with both Ruth Negga and Tessa Thompson. They're playing the main characters in an adaptation of Nella Larson's 1929 novel. And it's about a Black woman passing as white, but actually who's sort of dancing around the fictional color line in general. And And loneliness and performance, both of these two things we were talking about before the break, are a big part of what's happening in their characters. What struck you in the film?
Well, exactly as you say. I mean, it's, you know, we sometimes have an idea that, you know, there's that we have some authentic self, and that a performance is a way of dissembling or disguising or getting away from that self. And what passing does so brilliantly and disturbingly is to show how on both sides of that it doesn't quite work. So you have these two women who both Black women who have known each other since childhood, and they encounter each other in Manhattan one day. It's set in the 1920s, and the character played by Ruth Negga is living as a white woman. She's married to a quite racist white man, but the first thing that you see in the movie is the other character, Tessa Thompson, who lives in Harlem, is married to a Black doctor, is living a very kind of respectable upper middle class life there. You see her being mistaken for a white woman. You see her, you know, inadvertently, unintentionally, accidentally passing. And she becomes more and more obsessed and frustrated with her friend, and also more confined and frustrated by the performance that she has to put on as a respectable wife and mother and you know, upstanding citizen. So what's fascinating is that the Ruth Negga character experiences the freedom and also the risk and danger of her performance and of her crossing back and forth. So a lot of the times, you know, she comes up to Harlem and it's not clear what anyone up there thinks or knows about who she might be and what her background might be. But she does it with a great deal of kind of mischief and improvisational brilliance, and also a great sense of risk. Whereas Tessa Thompson character, who is increasingly kind of obsessed with and I think in love with her, is more and more, feels more and more hemmed in and constrained and imprisoned by her performance, which the world wouldn't even recognize as a performance. This is just her being right. Who she is. Right?
That's what I love, is it's not nominally a performance. She's just performing being middle class and being Black right. And being okay when she's not. She's not happy. The only thing that's true about that is that she's Black.
Right. I mean, and so she has to be a mother, and the way that she interacts with her children feels more and more kind of artificial and stiff and strange. And she interacts with her maid and her husband, and every one of these relations feels, and you can feel it feeling to her as something false, as something that's just not somehow who she is or who she wants to be. But she doesn't have any sense of an alternative, except maybe the sort of the example that kind of horrifies and also fascinates her of this friend who is living in this kind of this other dimension of performance, where she's in fact performing all the time, you know, and is aware of it, but is in some way in control of it.
Let's go to Allie in Brooklyn, who I think also loved Passing. Allie, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kai. It's Allie, who you know. I loved Passing. I was just talking about it with my partner, and it feels like it does ask more questions than give answers, which is something very rare in film in the last couple of years, especially in the films that have been streaming on Netflix. And, you know, I love that you find yourself not really knowing what was truthful and what wasn't truthful, and just sort of like an impression of what was happening in Tessa Thompson's character's mind at the end. It feels like a psychological thriller on top of, you know, all these bigger questions around race. And I honestly had not really witnessed the psychology of a Black woman in film in this way ever, I think. And so that was really refreshing as the perspective as well.
That's great. Thank you. Let's go to Anna, who's joining us from Sweden. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess we're in a United States of the world.
That's right.
No, I just wanted to give a shout out to Sadie Smith. She wrote this Intimations I used to pick up in a bookstore because I didn't have anything to read. And it's 6 essays. And it got her to her other essay collection, Grand Union. I haven't read her in a long time. And yeah, I tried to say earlier to the woman who first spoke to me here on the line and tried to say why it was good, but it's just really good. And she writes from the perspective of New York, and very, you know, she doesn't like put the gravity of it on page. You know, it's told very simple and very genuine, and it's just, but since she's doing it in such a simple and personal way, it just, you know, you can feel.
Right, right. Anna, thank you for both of those. Let's hear from Dan in Bridgewater, Connecticut. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi. Let me just first say that I'd give anything for dinner with your guest and a few other people so we could discuss the human condition. I mean, he really grasped a lot of things. The two movies, I'm a Cold War refugee, and I came to this country and was introduced to the race problem in America as opposed to how it was in Western Europe. And there were two movies that really struck me. One was 21 Bridges and the other one, The Green Book. And they show so eliminated that color line that is so artificially put in today, and it's such a big issue today as opposed to the human interaction line. And as a physician, I as an emergency room physician, I've seen both sides of the color line in this country, and in Vietnam at the front as opposed to the rear, these lines get completely obliterated. And there's this tremendous human unity that's being terribly barriered by color line, by nationality line, you know. And my wife is Chinese, so for her, her situation is very interesting. And I'm still waiting for Hollywood to make good movies. You know, when I raise my kids,
Dan, I'm gonna stop you there just for time. But thank you. And Tony, anything there that jumps out at you, particularly this idea of still waiting for Hollywood to make good movies about the color line?
You know, yes. I mean, Hollywood has, I think, a long history of not quite getting it right. Let's say, to be generous, there's a great book that I always teach by James Baldwin called The Devil Finds Work, which is his own personal history of involvement as a movie watching child and then as an adult trying to make movies with Hollywood's particular versions of the American racial neurosis. But there is a movie that has nothing to do with that did figure in my 10 best list and in my list of actings that goes to something that I think Dan was saying just about the sort of the feeling of a common humanity that can emerge across differences. And it's a movie called Drive My Car, a Japanese film. And the main character in it is a theater director. And the kind of theater he does these experimental productions of classic plays. So he does, at the beginning, he's doing Waiting for Godot, and then he's doing Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. But what he does is he has casts who come from all different countries, all performing in their own languages. So they're these multilingual performances where the people don't necessarily understand the words that each other are saying, but what they do understand is the emotions and the communicated meanings of the text, even though some of them are speaking Korean or Mandarin or Japanese or Tagalog. And the scenes of these rehearsals and performances where these characters are speaking unintelligible language to each other are some of the most powerful moments of acting that I have seen in a very long time. And go to that question of just what is it that we see in each other? How do we communicate? Where does this empathy and curiosity and human connection that is possible come from? And I've never quite seen it presented in such a powerful and strange and beautiful way, because we're all strangers to each other. We don't understand each other, and yet we're capable of some kind of recognition or connection. And I think art, and maybe in particular arts that involve performance, show us some of that.
We have to talk about West Side Story, of course. It's on your best of list. You said you chose it because, quote, mostly there are big emotions and memorable songs and unabashed faith that sincerity will always be stronger than cynicism. But of course, I mean, you also had a wonderful conversation with Tony Kushner, one of the authors of this adaptation, Tony Kushner and Steven Spielberg, about the tensions of this story, yeah. right? I mean, here we are again with, you know, a couple of white guys writing about Puerto Ricans in a work that has constantly been criticized for that. What did he tell you about that tension?
Yeah, it was very interesting to talk with him. It's funny that you mentioned this. A friend of mine last night said that my new job title should be New York Times West Side Story Bureau Chief. So, because I've spent a lot of time with this. But what Kushner said was a couple of things. One is that, you know, and this is not, you know, to excuse anything, but it is the original 1957 musical is very much a product of its time and place, and the ideas and sensibilities of the four men, Arthur Lawrence, Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, and Jerome Robbins, who made it, who sort of conceived of this idea of putting Romeo and Juliet, making a musical of it, and setting it among the youth gangs of the West Side, about which they did not know very much,
right.
and didn't necessarily bother to find out. And so, you know, their idea of what both the Anglo and the Puerto Rican gangs, you know, where they came from and who they were, was about as deeply researched maybe as Shakespeare's, you know, understanding of like Verona and Mantua and these places in Italy that he had never really been to. So, but I think Kushner and Spielberg were aware of the criticisms of both of the casting of the original film, which was mostly, you know, white actors in the Puerto Rican roles, with the notable significant exception of Rita Moreno. And they also, Kushner in particular, working on the screenplay, wanted to get into the history, wanted to say, well, okay, what was really going on at this period in this neighborhood? Who were these people really? You know, what was going on in the two different communities? What is the reality that underlines and underlies that original story? And I think they did a lot of very interesting work to bring that out, and to dramatize not just the eternal romance and tragedy and Romeo and Julietness of it all, but some of the American social and cultural reality that it grew out of, while still respecting, I think, the innovations in music and choreography, and also
we'll have to leave it there, Tony. We got to get to a break. But A.O. Scott is the co-chief film critic of the New York Times.
With a lot to say about West Side Story.
He's got lots to say about West Side Story. I suggest you go check him out and his best performances list of 2021. Up next, we'll turn to music. But we're going to look much further back than the past year. If I told you there was a Black woman in the 1930s who was basically as much of a global powerhouse as Beyoncé is today, could you name her? We'll talk about her life and her music after a break. We often think of universities as isolated ivory towers, but the fact is, politics have always been present on campus. This is Kai, and after you're done with our show this week, take a listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour, where David Remnick looks closely at what's been happening at Harvard.
The money factor, very important. What is it that college presidents do? One of their most important functions is raising money.
Law professor Randall Kennedy. He's worth a listen, and so is the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you get your podcasts. That is the trailblazing singer Marian Anderson. And here's another cool thing that happened in the arts this year. Sony Classical released a commemorative book about Anderson's legacy, including 15 compact discs. Yes, I said compact discs, featuring her entire catalog of RCA Victor recordings. That's 42 years of songs. And it just made us think, here's this Black woman, a classical musician who, in the 1930s, was full on Beyoncé. I mean, at one point, she was the highest paid singer in the United States. This Black woman in an overwhelmingly white space. She was a global superstar. And yet, I suspect many listeners know next to nothing about her, very much including me. So let's learn something about Marian Anderson and her music. I called up one of the great voices of American radio, Terrence McKnight, the evening host of WQXR here in New York City, who is working on a book about Black artists and the classical stage. And he had a lot to say about Miss Anderson. Terrence, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So if people know one big factoid about Marian Anderson, it's that she held this famous controversial concert at the Lincoln Memorial in 1939. So remind us of that story. What happened and why was it important historically?
In 1939, Marian Anderson sang on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. 75,000 people came out to hear her sing. It was a radio broadcast. She started by singing, "My Country, 'Tis of Thee."
My country, 'tis of thee, sweet London, liberty, who thee we see.
And it really shook the country, because for someone who at this point in her career was in her 40s, someone who had sung with the New York Philharmonic, someone who had given a debut at Town Hall, someone who had toured throughout Europe and was considered the busiest singer in America, Asia, and Europe in the 1930s. And she sang at Lincoln Memorial on 39 because she had been refused a concert in Washington, D.C. Howard University was trying to bring her. And the Daughters of the American Revolution denied her Constitution Hall. As a result, the president's wife got involved. Eleanor Roosevelt got involved. She was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. So she resigned as a result of them discriminating against this Black singer who had conquered three continents. You know, she sang to thousands in Lewiston Stadium in New York in 1925. So almost 15 years later, she's being discriminated against just because of her skin tone. And that was a big deal. One of the listeners that day to that 1939 concert was a 10-year-old Martin King Jr. And he entered an essay contest at school. And he talked about Marian Anderson. And, you know, he said, "She sang as never before with tears in her eyes. When the words of America rang out over that great gathering, there was a hush on the sea of uplifted faces, Black and white, and a new baptism of liberty, equality, and fraternity." King went on to say, "But Miss Anderson may not as yet spend the night in any good hotel in America." So she inspired a young Martin King, and she inspired a generation and generations of singers. Man, I think about seeing Sade a few years ago.
Yeah.
It was more than a few. And I just remember she barely moved, yet she commanded the attention of the audience. Just pure elegance. And when you look at Marian Anderson, that's what you get on stage and off stage. Just pure dignity, elegance. And when she opens her mouth to sing, it's all there, man. And I think that's why she was able to just capture the attention of so many people for so many decades.
And she left the United States fairly early in her career, right? I mean, she'd gone to Europe in the 20s, I gather in part because she had to escape segregation here in order to be a performer.
Well, she got an opportunity. You know, she, after high school, she wanted to go to music school in Philadelphia, but was denied. They said they didn't accept coloreds. And she got the scholarship from NAM, National Association of Negro Musicians, who provided her with funding, as did her church, Union Baptist Church in Philadelphia. to study privately. So she got a private teacher, and her talent was just phenomenal. And word got out. And then she went off to Europe, man. She was singing so much. I think there was a 6-month period where she sang 120 concerts.
Wow. And was that typical back then? I mean, was that the kind of work that people did, or was she just like an over-the-top worker?
I think she just loved to sing. And there was the opportunity. Now, and the other thing to remember is that when she was born in 1897, and through the first few decades of her career, the most potent type of American entertainment was minstrelsy. So that's what she was up against. She was the antithesis to how minstrelsy portrayed Black folks. Mm. And so I'd imagine there was a shock as she stood up there and she was able to sing in French and in German and Italian and in English for that matter.
Yeah.
Marian Anderson was able to accomplish all of this in the 20s and 30s. And then, you know, certainly we can move up to the 50s because up to this point, there weren't Black singers singing at the Metropolitan Opera. And so that was still another barrier that had to be torn down, and she did it.
In 1955, she becomes the first Black singer at the Met, correct?
That's correct. Interestingly enough, she sang The Masked Ball. It's a Verdi opera, in which Verdi had asked for this character. She played the character of Ulrika, which was a witch. And Verdi had asked that this person be of color. And so typically that role was sung by someone in blackface. They didn't have to do it that night.
Yeah. Red de la ville soit frais, pâti,
précipita. And I think I will say that I believe she was the highest paid singer on stage that night.
Okay, you get it, Marian. tell us more about the music itself and her contribution to the sort of American music itself. She started with gospel.
Well, I'm going to say, well, let's call it spirituals because okay. As she was growing up, gospel music hadn't really happened. It didn't happen until late 1920s and 30s. So Marian grew up singing those spirituals, that authentic, you know, American music that informed jazz, that informed so much of our vernacular music now. That's what she grew up to, and that's what she was so famous for singing. You know, you can't think about he's got the whole world in his hands without going back to Marian Anderson. She really made that tune sing.
He's got the big round world in his hands. He's got the wide world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands.
Well, you know, man, anytime young musicians who grow up in church, that church audience is tough. If you've ever had to say an Easter speech or some kind of speech in front of a church congregation,
I
grew
up
in a Baptist church, so I know those folks. They know real when they see it and when they hear
it. Yes, indeed.
You know, they want to get you right. So Marian Anderson grew up sort of going to two churches. Her mom was Methodist, her father was Baptist, but her father's sister was a singer, and she was going to the Baptist church. So her pops would take her to hear her aunt sing. And, you know, by the time she was 10 years old, she joined a chorus in Philadelphia. And then I believe she gave her first solo in church at 11 years old. So if you can stand up in front of the church folks, you learn how to do the job. And oftentimes it was said about Miss Anderson's performances that they seemed so intimate, as if she was singing in a salon or a parlor. Mm. And I think that had something to do with that small church upbringing.
And in classical and operatic music, what was it about her musical style, her singing style that was unique or that we need to know to understand her?
For one, it was her range. I mean, she was a contralto, so she could sing very deep and with a lot of husk.
Lord, how
but she could also sing, you know, very bright and high. And so she had just this wide range, but also, you know, just, I mean, if I could explain it, I could do it, and I can't. You just know it when you hear it. I've spent the last couple of days just listening to her just go from Handel to spirituals to Bach to music for the holidays. I mean, and it's very special. I mean, there were folks who said she was had the voice of a generation or the voice that you hear in a century. And it's true.
Is there a particular song in the classical and operatic tradition that you think, dear listener, if you're going to go out and be introduced to Marian Anderson in her range today, go download this?
If you've ever felt that someone didn't like you, listen to her saying, "He was despised." Comes from Handel's Messiah, and she'll make you feel a little better. She'll make you feel okay about folks not really caring for you in that moment. She really captures what Handel was trying to get across in that music. I mean, you get the sense that it's personal. And that's the thing about her. I mean, no matter what she was singing, she made it seem so personal, like she had lived that experience.
Mm. Do you remember discovering her or when she first sort of touched you?
It's hard to remember, you know, but one thing that I found touching is something I learned about her recently. And, you know, she started her, well, you know, that big concert you were talking about, 1939, that was Easter Sunday. Well, she gave her last recital as a singer, Easter Sunday, 1965. But she didn't leave the stage. She continued to narrate. She did Lincoln Portrait by Aaron Copland. And she continued to advocate for justice and integration and equality. Her nephew, James DePriest, became an important conductor in Oregon, in Portland. But he was also heavily involved in New York. He was assistant conductor with the New York Philharmonic. And then he was a conductor with the Symphony of the New World, the first integrated professional orchestra in the country. That was in the 60s. Well, Marian would go on stage with that orchestra and, you know, just show up. And she would, you know, try to raise money for that orchestra, raising money for the cause of integration. Mm-hmm. And one of the musicians, he was telling me the other day, he said, "I remember James DePriest conducting Symphony of the New World. And after the concert, he said, 'Okay, we're going to go to my auntie's house.'" He said, so he didn't think much about it. And they got on a train, went uptown, came to this apartment. And he said, there was a woman walking around serving tea with an apron on. And when he turned around, it was Marian Anderson. And he said, but she was just so elegant and she served us tea. And so this thing about her humility, it just wasn't on stage. You know, it was something that she carried with her seemingly in her personal life.
I have to say, before I let you go, you're working on a book about not only Marian Anderson, but about Black folks and classical music in general. You want to give us a tease and when it's coming?
I'm off to a good start. Finishing is something I'll have to ask you about on the sidelines. But yeah, I think, you know, the relationship that Black artists have to classical music is an untold story. So it's not a historical look at Blacks and classical music. It's more taking interviews of folks that I've come across over the years, many of whom are in their 90s and 80s, who were there at that point of integration, who were there also when you had Negro orchestras. So hopefully I'll expose some things that folks hadn't thought about. And my purpose, man, is to find a way forward that's more inclusive. So when we go to the concert hall, we see all of our culture up there together and not this hierarchy of culture, and certainly not just Black composers or Black artists in February or March, but something that's more reflective of, you know, what America can be.
Thank you so much for this time, Terrence.
Kai, thanks so much for having me talk about what I love talking about.
All right.
Trying to make heaven my home.
Terrence McKnight hosts the evening show on WQXR here in New York City. That's our sister station, which just celebrated 85 years on the air playing classical music. You can catch his show every weeknight at 7 p.m. Eastern. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Sound designed by Jared Paul. Milton Ruiz was at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frillman, and Kusha Navidar. And I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright or send me an email at anxiety@wnyc.org. And of course, I hope you'll join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at wnyc.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.